What are the tips, tricks, and tactics working in today's entrepreneurial environment? The strategies, the practices, the psychology, and the exact how to grow in your business or start a new one. How to blow up your personal brand and supercharge your personal growth. That's our promise, and this is your next favorite podcast. My name is JP Fluellen, and welcome to Success Agent Podcast. All right, let's talk about today's anti-sponsor for the show. The anti-sponsor just means that they didn't pay me to actually do this. I actually am a real estate broker for real, and I get to do this because I serve as one of their managing brokers. And for real, if you're a team or anywhere in the North America and you're looking to find a great home where you can build your business, grow your team, grow your revenue streams, grow more profits, and grow your wealth, and also build a legacy where you can leave this behind for your team, your staff, your family for years to come, you should check out The Real Brokerage. Just go to go.joinreal.com and check out all the cool things that Real has to offer. So if you're a real estate brokerage in North America, this may be interesting to you. So there's my pitch for the anti-sponsor, but let's get into today's episode. Hey guys, welcome to another episode of the Success Agent Podcast. And in today's episode, we are going to talk about all the things you need to know about how to be successful in real estate investing in 2024 and beyond. And I have a special guest today, Tom Zeeb. I've known of this guy for like 20 years. And, you know, this guy is a legend. You just don't know his name yet, but you will. And so I'm super excited about this episode because I've just vicariously been watching this guy for a really long time. And so let's kick this thing off, Tom. Tell us about yourself. Tell us about all the secrets that we are missing on how to be uber successful in real estate investing in 2024 and beyond.
Thanks for having me, JP. I think the big thing that people are missing, the skill, the one thing they need to hone in on to get better at everything, to get more deals and more profits out of each deals, is quite simply negotiation. Get better at negotiation. People worry about, you know, are my margins slimming? Are there less deals out there? Are there less sellers out there? Is there more chaos out there? The answer is always, right? The things are always changing.
Yeah.
The one thing you can always get better at is your own internal skills, and learning how to negotiate is the key as a real estate investor.
So when you're talking about, like, because we see this all the time, there's houses, there's the foreclosures, there's the, you know, the auction sites, all these things, there's different places you can find all these properties. But like, how do you like start off with the negotiation process, like finding the sellers, setting the appointment, getting in the home, having the conversation? And then they're like, they give you their whole 5,000, you know, words, you know, synopsis of all the things that are going wrong in their life. And then they tell you, I want $350,000. You know, the house is only worth $180,000, you know, before rehab. And then they're like, not realistic. Like, how does that conversation even start?
Well, first off, I want to have that conversation on the phone first. Before I go over there, before I drive out there, before I'm stuck in traffic or driving a long distance or whatever, just investing that hour or 2 hours to do it, I want to make sure it's got a snowball's chance. On the phone first. So I'm bringing them through that and trying to pre-qualify them before I get to the point. Like, I want it to be at least have the likelihood of becoming a deal on the phone first. Then I'll invest the time to go out and see it, because when I'm there, I could be pointing out other things and digging deeper and pulling some more layers off of the onion so that I can get the price down even further.
And so if you, you know, they say, yeah, great, come on over, you get there, and the house is way worse than, you know, and you're just like, there ain't no way I could even give them anything close to what I was even originally thinking.
Yeah.
So how does that conversation even go?
Well, I got to talk to them about that. I got to point everything out. And then a lot of times, if they're still skeptical, because most times people are hung up on some number they have in their mind. You know, they got the number from what they think the neighbor's house sold for, or what they think they saw in the news, or what some sort of online valuation system told them, which is never terribly accurate. Then I need to attack their idea of that number. And specifically, a lot of times I have to do it. I call it the technique I used to overcome it. I call it show your math or show your work. You remember in high school, your math class, your teacher said, show your work. That was to make sure you weren't cheating. Right? You can actually see that it was, you know, you had gone through the problem. Well, a lot of times if you're trying to pull somebody off of their number, particularly if that number is wrong, you have to show your work. So I go through and show them, no, this is what properties are actually selling for. Let's go through this house and let me show you what everything needs to be fixed. And I'm going to put prices to that. I'm literally showing them the work, because the number one thing is if they're asking $300,000 and you're only going to be offering $150,000, they're still thinking it's worth $300,000, and they're in their mind, they're going, you're going to make $150,000, when, because we all know that's not true, because we know we have expenses. So you're looking at it going, well, one, that's not the value. Two, even if that were the value all fixed up, that's not the case for what it is. Let me show you all the work I'm going to put into this, what the cost of my labor is, the cost of materials, the cost of my tax, the cost of borrowing my money, and the very prudent thing of having a fudge factor for what happens if things go wrong. Now look at what my profit actually will be. I don't hide the fact I'm making a profit. I just don't want them thinking it's that giant spread they think that it is.
Sure. So then you got your seller and they're like, oh, you investors, you want to all, you know, all you guys want to get rich. You know what I mean? Like, you've had the conversation a million times, right? And so how do you overcome that, those initial predictable, constant, you know, objections?
I'll pick on it, meaning it's almost an obvious thing. Like, yeah, I'm one of those late night TV guys. I read that and I drank the Kool-Aid.
Yeah.
And look, obviously, I hope like the way I'm saying that, it's dripping with sarcasm.
Yeah.
And so I'm saying it to them the same way with a smile and go, look, in all seriousness, let me show you. Now, again, I love me a good skeptic. So if they're skeptical, even more so the fact that I'm going to have to pull out the numbers and walk them through the math. Now, look. In my mind, I might have a rosier estimate. I'm going to show worst case scenario. I'm going to show retail prices on the rehab, because that's what they could do it for. The fact that I could do it for better is my business, not theirs. But I'm going to show them the math on kind of worst case scenario and what things, and that's how I'm going to get them off of their price and get them talking to me.
Yeah. So then when you get there and they're like, yeah, you know, they've already given you the sob story over the phone. You get there, the sob story is even way worse, because they, you know, of course, usually these are the same folks that you're, you know, that like to tell stories and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Then you find out that there's a lien on the property, you know, and then now your numbers are all out of whack. So Usually at that point, do you guys just typically back out, or you figure out a way to wholesale it? How do you navigate through that process?
Well, I'll figure out if there's a way to still make it into a deal. Now, if I'm wholesaling, that doesn't mean that if I change the numbers, my rehabber wants it or my landlord wants it, right? I'm wholesaling to a buyer. They're a rehabber or they're a landlord. So it still has to be a deal for them. So the real thing is, how can I still maintain it being a deal for them and still make it a deal for me? You know, have some padding in there, have a spread for me. And if things change and there's a surprise lien, I've framed it so that that's on the seller, because I've asked them early on as part of my negotiation, hey, you know, tell me what we're dealing with here. Any issues? Why are you selling? When we go to do the title work, is there going to be any surprises? Oh, no surprises. Then when there is a surprise, like, well, you didn't tell me about that one. Look, those liens are on you. That's your doing from the past. You don't get to escape. It's like death and taxes. You can't escape.
Yeah. Yeah, I've seen that quite often. And then, you know, if it's wrapped up in a trust or something, and somebody that was on there has, you know, they owe medical bills or all this kind of stuff that's been tacked on top of the properties. Do you usually just renegotiate price then, if there's enough margin to get them to take care of that stuff? Because that obviously wasn't part of your as is, where is, we pay all your closing costs, you know, all that kind of stuff. And then you're like, bro, I didn't say I'd pay your medical bills.
Yeah, I'm not paying your medical bills. I'm not paying your tax bill.
Yeah.
Or the one I love is that they've refinanced in the last couple of years. And all that money's already gone. But now for some reason they think, and I'm like, well, wait a minute, you got all the money out of this property already. How much more lemonade do you think you can squeeze out of this lemon?
Yeah.
There's some of that. Sometimes it's just being very frank and forthright with people, not making them feel stupid about what they've done, but pointing out what it is so that they move on. And sometimes, look, honestly, JP, sometimes you got to walk away for a little bit. Right? Like, let me let that sink in and walk away for a week. That gives them time. That gives it time to sink into their mind. It also gives them time to go try to find another solution. They can't. They come back to the person that was already kind of correct with them and honest with them and straightforward with them.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and so when your initial, you know, talking to the folks and you've got your initial plan and let's say now, you know, everything's going good or whatever, you go and order the payoff and they owe way more. Have you ever pivoted into like either like a novation deal or even a like sub two? I know that's the big buzzword right now these days is sub two everything, you know, go in with $5,000 and just sub two everything. Like, what are your thoughts on that stuff moving forward?
I almost always offer sub two at the beginning. The thing is, most people want a clean break and they want to get out. They're going, oh, subject to, you mean I'm still going to own it for a few? I'm not done yet. They're still, so they, if anything, that kind of legs them into wanting, they want my cash offer. They just want it at a higher price. So as long as we don't go above my maximum, I'm all right with that.
Nice. Nice. And so are you using a lot of hard money, your own money? You got like a little collective of cash investors that are just want to throw money at deals. Like, how is that what you're seeing now? Is, or are you doing a lot of just your own stuff? I would assume since you're a legend, you know, you're just like throwing cash around, like you're just making it rain. No, I'm well, just playing.
All right. Well, thanks. But here's the thing. if you're throwing your own cash around, you're actually killing your return on investment.
Sure. No, that right? Makes sense. Yeah.
Right. The generally you're trying to get in with leverage. Now that's in one point. The other point is if I'm wholesaling, I'm not using any of my own money anyway. I'm only making cash and not an offer, but I'm making a cash payout on it. So it's my rehabber that's paying for it or my landlord that's paying for it. It's the buyer because there's nothing for them to do then. They don't have to mess around with the marketing, the big mystery of marketing. They don't have to deal with the headache of the negotiation. Literally, I serve it to my buyer on a silver platter. Hello, Mr. Rehabber. Here's a great deal. Go rehab it. Oh, great. They don't have to deal with the part they don't like. Hello, Mr. Landlord, Miss Landlord. Here's the deal. Perfect for you. Ready to go. That's what they're paying a wholesaler for. And so I don't have to worry about where I'm getting my financing from.
Yeah, no, that's fair. And are you doing more wholesale deals this now than doing like fix and flips?
Well, so it's interesting. Yes, I am back to almost exclusively wholesaler. I build up from wholesaling, got into rehabbing, got into buy and holds. Quite a number of years went by. And this last 2 years, I've been backing out of everything. I sold my last rental about 7 months ago. So I've been rehabbing off the rentals, selling them off. I now don't have a buy and hold portfolio, and I'm a very happy.
Wow.
Yeah.
So tell me about that. What was the rationale behind that process?
If I say too many things, your videos and audios might get banned by big tech. But some of it is think of all the nonsense going on the last few years.
Yeah.
And it's bothered me. Like not being able to evict was crazy.
Yeah.
I mean, absolutely crazy. I started to take a loss on one property. I managed to recover it during an eviction process. But I've had many of my students and other investors I talked to that have taken massive baths. I mean, they've been absolutely crushed by not being able to evict. When people know they don't need to pay, they don't pay. And so I thought that was kind of nonsense. And then where I had chosen to do my buy and holds at one time was a very up and coming area. All that kind of turned around and went haywire. And then that jurisdiction said, well, you can't even Airbnb unless you live there. I'm like, well, how am I supposed to live in all these different properties? That doesn't even make any sense. So I literally said, let me just start to get rid of them. And let me get rid of them before I, you know, because I saw the market in that specific area softening and I wanted to get out. So I did. That's a personality thing on me. That's a lifestyle thing, a choice on my part. I just didn't want to deal with any of the crap.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Yeah, we're lucky to where we live. The landlord-tenant laws are still pretty landlord-friendly. And even during COVID, you know, they're like, you can't evict except, and then there was these exceptions. And so we're like, well, how do I use these exceptions to my advantage? And they're, you know, so we scrutinized all of our leases, found all the loopholes, got tenants out that needed to get out. Yeah. And, you know, it actually worked in our favor. And all that stimulus money they were using to pay for rents for Infinity, you know, we had to do some creative maneuvers there too, but all within, you know, the confines of the law, of course, you know. Absolutely. I mean, you know, but it is what it is. I mean, you know, I mean, there's certain risks that you take on as a tenant, and there's certain risks you take on as a landlord. Yeah. And you just got to figure out.
And the law can still be lunacy, right? I want to follow the letter of the law too, because it's the right thing to do. But yeah, sometimes the laws are lunacy, but you follow them anyway because you're law abiding. Well, so yeah, it was the same thing. Is it mean and nasty to evict a tenant? It's not. Look, it's not fun. It's not great. But you know what? I don't consider it very nice, polite, and proper for them to be stealing from me.
Right.
Not paying rent when you're living in my property is theft. You're stealing from me. You can't walk into the corner store. Well, I guess you could these days, but you can't walk in and just you can't walk in and walk out with stuff without paying. It's not right. It's not right. And that when I saw that happening in the jurisdictions I was operating in, I said, let me do a sell off. I'll go back into a cash position and then I'll redeploy when I see something I like.
Have you thought about your dreams of home ownership, or maybe you're downsizing, or maybe your family is growing? Getting a loan is now as fresh as getting a morning cup of coffee. Java Mortgage, based in Wyoming, offers FHA, VA, conventional loans with competitive rates. We are a Wyoming-based mortgage broker, so we can get banks to compete so you get the best deal. With our second look guarantee, if we can't beat your current deal, we'll give you a $100 Home Depot gift card, and that's our promise. Go to www.javamortgage.com, and again, that's www.javamortgage.com. Click the apply now to get started. NMLS 2316625, an equal housing lender. All right, back to the show. So I saw in your bio that you don't like marketing that much. So tell me about marketing in your world. And yeah.
You say facetiously, I hope, because yeah, I love marketing. I love negotiation. Two things that are the lifeblood of our business. We got to be able to find deals.
Yeah.
And then you got to be able to make them into a deal, because even when you find a lead, it's not red hot and ready to go. It's lukewarm at best. We've got to take good negotiation skills and turn it into a red hot deal. So great deals they're made, they're not found, but you've got to find that initial lead, and that's from solid marketing. So yeah, I love getting focused in on the marketing, because that's also how I view that I'm helping people the most. I'm finding people that need my help.
Yeah. And is there a specific avenue that you're finding more success in than others? You know, because I know we talked about some software that you're using and things like that. Is that kind of using specific systems around software to then generate the viable leads that you can take action on? Or are you doing, I know you mentioned mailers. I know all this old school stuff still works. It's just, you know, these new kids out there, they're just like, dude, nobody does mailers, you know, because I mean, you know.
Okay. Yeah. The kids these days. Yeah. We mentioned that, I think, offline before we started.
Yeah.
So I still love direct mail, letters, postcards, love it. And the fact that the kids these days can only deal in electronic things, well, which disappears like a fart in the wind half the time, mm-hmm. You know, but a postcard or a letter shows up at your door. I guarantee it gets looked at, because you've got to decide whether or not to throw it out. So I know it's being looked at. I know that message is at least popping across. If you're interested, you can follow through and take some action. You know, give me a ring or hit my website. If you're not into it, then you throw it out. But at least you read it, where a lot of the noise online these days can be a bit ridiculous. So I still love direct mail, very almost neck and neck these days. I've always liked driving for deals, going around and finding properties. But I specifically love it now with a software called Deal Machine that I've been using, my students have been using. We've been crushing it with this. It makes all the long list of things we had to do when we would drive for deals. But now that's all integrated and taken care of on the fly, on the spot. So I don't go driving for deals and come home with a to-do list anymore. I go driving for deals and come home with a to-done list. It's already done, and I like it that way.
And are you using a call center to follow up on your deals? Are you doing them all personally, or how are you managing the flow, the deal flow then on the back end?
My phone is initially answered by a team of virtuals that answer the phone. So virtual assistants, virtual secretaries answer the phone, take the initial information down. Then it's tagged based on certain responses. It either comes to me as priority, and then I'll do the callback, because a large part of negotiation is rapport, and a large part of rapport is quite simply how long has someone spoken to you. The longer you talk to somebody, you're building rapport. And so I want the rapport built with me, not with the operator on the phone.
Gotcha. And I know there was a number thrown out a while ago, and I don't, in your world, I just want to check to see if it's still accurate, which is about $2,500 to a closed deal, like ish.
Ish, maybe. Hard to say, because some people do it more cost effective than others. It also depends which type of marketing you're using.
Yeah.
Direct mail runs up a cost. Networking doesn't. Driving for deals is minimal. Cold calling, minimal. There's an inverted scale. Some forms of marketing cost more money. Those don't tend to take very much time, though. So their time cost is low, the dollar cost is high. But then there's other kinds of marketing where it's the opposite. They don't cost much, but they take some time. And then there's kind of everything in between. So I think a good marketing plan is a blend. You've got to set what's your financial budget and work within that, and what's your time budget and work within that. Some people, they've got a good paying job. They've got a pension. They've got all this financial security. They just don't have much time. Well, then spend the money to get the leads. And if you're the other way around, if you're broke as a joke, and you don't have a penny to your name, well, then do the ones that take more time. Because generally those people tend to be time rich and money poor. So there's something out there in terms of marketing for everyone. You've got to determine what that is.
Okay, so let me twist this question a little bit here. So scale, to do this at scale, because obviously like when you're doing a few deals, you're getting some success, you've done all the running around, you've done the cold calls, you've done the door knocking, driving for dollars, all the things, you've done the mailers. Now you're starting to see some results, but it's just not good enough. And you know how it is, us real estate guys, like you never can get enough going. Cause it's just I call it the thrill of the deal. I don't know what you call it, but I just love like having the conversation and then seeing the smile on the face when you get them all excited that you're solving a problem, and then you know that there's a deal and that you're going to make money on the back end, and it's all the fun stuff, the designing and the flipping and the wholesaling, you got your buyer's list and all the things. So, but you're not, you want to do, let's say, because you said in your bio, you don't like goals either, which is also interesting, which to me, I'm like, well, my goal is I want to do 5 deals a month. Yeah. So to do this at scale, especially going into 2024, when margins are a lot tighter, the cost of goods and services and materials and all these things are a lot more expensive than they were, 20 years ago. How do you do this at scale?
Yeah, good question. I need to define what I said about goals as well. Make sure I just think sometimes goals.
See, it makes it more interesting.
How does he not like goals? Aren't goals a good thing? I think some goal setting is cheesy. People get very pie in the sky. I think the problem with goals is people set them too high. When you said you want to do 5 deals, that's a reasonable goal. When you say I want to do 500 deals this week, that's an absurd, ridiculous goal. And so if you're setting goals that are self-defeating, that you know. Consciously and subconsciously, you can't do it. Well, then you're falling behind, and you've shot yourself in the foot before you've even started running. So what I like to see people do is have a just very reasonable goal that you can achieve. What's the very next thing you have to do? Get it done. Very next thing you have to do and get it done. It's okay to know a direction of where you want to be. I'd rather have an outcome that I'm after than a goal. I know I'm playing with the words and I'm splitting the words, but I think words are important. I think the meaning of words is important. So have an outcome that you are after and avoid that cheesiness of goal. Goals are like New Year's resolutions. Mm-hmm, you know, most people have forgotten what they are by January 20th.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, so what was the point? It just felt good at the time. There was a little bit of hopium. I mean, what was the point? You know, you want to have more of a major outcome.
Okay, so let me think about this for a second. So, but what if I'm an investor and I want to make $1 million a year? Let's say it's $1 million net. I haven't done a deal, but yet I want to scale. And so if I'm thinking too small, then I might not take enough action.
Yeah. On the other hand, $1 million a year is about 82 grand a month. And if you're saying $1 million net, then you need to be netting profit of $82,000 a month or 82 something, whatever, 82, 83 grand. Is that the right thing to start with? Because that takes something. Here's the thing. And in many ways, I'm shocked that I'm the one saying this because I've never considered myself very patient. But my grandfather said it all the time. Rome wasn't built in a day.
Yeah.
So I don't mind your goal. It's a great goal. Get to $1 million. But will it necessarily happen within the year? Maybe you need a little bit longer. Have some patience. And again, other people consider me patient. Personally, every time I think internally, I want everything now, right? Now, mm-hmm. faster. And yet Rome wasn't built in a day. Sometimes we just need to be patient on that. And let's do it. It was built, just not in the day. So let's make sure we're doing the right things, moving in the right direction. Does this move me closer to my desired outcome or my goal, if you insist on using the word? Then, you know, great or not. If it doesn't, I'm not doing the right thing. If I am, fine, I'm moving in the right direction. And as you get moving in the right direction and get those first few successes under your belt, a funny thing happens. You start to see ways you can improve your efficiency, improve the process, get more deals, get more money out of each deal. And you'll find yourself moving towards that desired outcome of that $1 million a lot faster. But I think if it's risky, though, if the opposite thing occurs where you go, oh, man, see, I had this pie in the sky goal. I wanted $1 million bottom line, which is, if you're running 50% profit, that might be $2 million in a year. That's a big change for people. Most people aren't going to jump from zero to 2 million in a year. I'm sorry. Other people tell you that. Other people sell you that. It's just not going to happen. But you can get to 500,000, 750,000, 250,000, and start from there. And now you're, now I've got something. Let me work on it and improve it.
That's awesome. So now that we've said kind of all the things that most people need to just start thinking about, where do you see real estate investing either changing? Do you see AI involved in any of this stuff? I mean, that's the big buzzword right now. Do you see any kind of big fundamental changes in real estate? And especially now, I don't know if you heard about what's going on with NAR and all these things. And, you know, so like the landscape even of like, I have a deal, I got to rehab a deal. Now I got to put it on the market and, you know, for sale by owner isn't as efficient as it used to, you know, as it could be. So where do you see like moving forward into 2024 and beyond as far as real estate investing is concerned?
Yeah. All right. So there's always going to be some changes, be it tech changes, legal changes that, operational changes for the way certain industries work. But there's a couple of things that always absolutely stay the same. And one of those is the basic human needs, food, clothing, shelter. We deal with shelter, don't mm-hmm. we, right? Those things we deal with shelter. That's not a need that's going away. That can never go away. So markets change. They go up, they go down, they stay flat, they roll sideways. But at the end of the day, people need what we offer. They need what we do. And people get, from my perspective as an investor, I'm generally looking for people that are in trouble with a property. Well, the last time I checked, human beings don't have a darn bit of trouble getting into trouble, right? All these things happen. They get divorced, they get old, they die and leave inherited properties. They let their properties get run down. Their tenants drive them nuts and they become tired landlords. They move out of state. They start having kids that need more space. Their kids grow up and leave the house, they need less space. But there's a whole bunch of different things. Those things that happen in life, those are happening no matter what happens to the economy, no matter what happens to the legal situation, no matter what. Problems will always happen to people. And so when my business is based on helping people solve their problems and using their real estate to solve those other problems in their life, I've always got a business.
Yeah. So that solves all the issues moving forward then, I guess. So I have a question for you, since you do a lot of wholesaling. I haven't actually done any wholesale deals. I've done some wholesale deals, but I haven't done any wholesaling. Where do you see, because I know you've probably heard this before, that wholesalers are being threatened because they're not actually taking any ownership, and then some ethics behind, you know, if you can't close on the property, then you shouldn't wholesale it. So what are your thoughts on the future of wholesaling?
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. Some states have gotten a little crazy like that. The basis that I always operated on is when you have a contract on a property, you have equitable interest. And that equitable interest is your rights and responsibilities in that contract. And you can sell that equitable interest. So I'm selling my position in the contract rather than actually selling the property. Now, some states and some attorneys out there, you know, that are, oh, well, that's not true. You don't actually have, you can't sell your equitable interest. All right, I disagree, but that may not matter in certain states, but then I'll stay out of those states because I don't like it. Now, should I buy it first? Well, that's great. Let me run up my expenses by buying the property. Let me run up my expenses by double closing and having double title work and double settlement costs and double doc prep fees. Oh, and wait a minute, who's the really big beneficiary? If I buy it first and then resell it, so, you know, wholesale like a double closing, now I'm subject to short-term capital gains tax. Now, maybe that's the real thing. The real thing people are after here is this ridiculous tax where I'm going to lose around a third of my deal. So if I make 10 grand, I got to throw 3,500 bucks away. That doesn't even make sense. And so that makes me wonder a little bit. What's the real purpose here?
Yeah. So like, as far as the, so I have a question. So this is a technical question. Yeah. When you're doing your assignment fee and it's on the settlement statement, then there's an assignment fee when you do that. And then tell me about how you have that conversation. Because you don't usually have the assignment fee until after it gets assigned, right?
The way I do it, which of course I argue is the right way. That's why I do it that way. I do not take my money until settlement. And my money, my assignment fee is fully disclosed on the settlement sheet. I want it on that ALTA settlement sheet fully disclosed because I have absolutely no compunction about showing what I've made on it. I'm not hiding anything. So all this, you know, a lot of people double close to hide, or they're trying to find odd ways of hiding it. One, my buyer knows what they're paying me anyway, because they've seen my original contract and they've signed my assignment contract, which flat out states how much they're paying me. So there's nothing to hide from them. My seller, I am helping my seller get out of trouble. Yeah. My seller is walking away with the deal they wanted because that's what I've negotiated with them. They're happy with the price. They're happy with their situation. They're happy to be free of this property. And they don't, you know, they know they didn't call a charity. I'm not doing it as charitable work. They know I'm a business. And because I tell them that as well, hey, you know, one of the ways I'm going to make some money on the deal is I'm going to pull a wholesale fee out as I pass it off to one of my buyers. And they generally don't care. What they care about is how much are they making and are they free from the headache of this house?
Yeah.
And a lot of people don't seem to believe that up front. But you just have to do it and watch what happens.
Yeah,
your report is set right. They're not going to be upset with you.
And it's having the correct conversations in order to get the correct results, versus getting anxiety around talking about money. And this, I think, that's where a lot of wholesalers get themselves in trouble. Oh, they're not going to believe me that I do what I do because, you know, whatever, you know, you know, and then there's a lot of, I think, false statements around the results of these types of deals, because they don't like talking about making money when the whole point of doing it in the beginning is making money, or you wouldn't do it, right?
You wouldn't do it. I don't think many people would go to work every day if they didn't need to make money. It's, you know, there can be money grubbing evil people out there, but that doesn't have to be you. It's also just basic subsistence. And so why be ashamed of your chosen profession? I'm not ashamed of being a real estate investor. I help a lot of people. I ask them for testimonial letters or to film a testimonial video with me after each transaction. So they're telling me how happy and thrilled they are with me. That does two things. One, it locks into my mind how much I've helped them, and it feels good for me. But two, it's locked them in because they've complimented me and they've talked about how good that is. So obviously that's going to be good when I show that to new sellers that haven't made up their mind to work with me yet. It also makes sure that no one can ever turn around and say, I screwed that person over, because here they are in their own words talking about how great it was to work with me. So I think when people start to realize that, some of this fear of oh my God, if they find out how much I'm making, it's going to be a bad thing. No, it's not.
Yeah, it's having the conversation up front, talking, being a real person, you know, and connecting with the people that you're trying to help, and that, you know, it's a better and more efficient way of working with you than it is to do something, you know, the alternative, you know. And we see that quite often, even in the realtor space. You know, nowadays with what's going on in the world, we're having a whole lot more conversations about how real estate agents get paid too. So it's very interesting to see that, you know, if you're just transparent and you'll be a good person and have ethics around what you're doing, that it's just way less stressful. You know, it's amazing how that works. Well, awesome, Tom. Well, thank you so much for being here, man. Like, so do you have anything for our audience? Like, you know, I know you're doing mentorship and teaching students how to like get off the ground with real estate investing. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I've got some free training gifts that your people might enjoy. One's on marketing, one's on negotiation. So if you go to tomzeeb.com, T-O-M, Z as in zebra, E-E-B as in boy.com. That's my podcast on the art and science of real estate negotiation. But then if you put a forward slash after that and write the word trifecta, like, you know, if you pick all three horses, I'll go through my top three negotiation techniques where I really go through in detail. You'll learn them. You'll use them. You'll love them because they'll start making you good money. That's the negotiation bonus. If you put in deal flow, so tomzeeb.com/dealflow, DEALFLOW, you'll have my key to finding your next five deals. It's five things I do to connect with motivated sellers and improve my marketing so that I'm improving my response rate.
Awesome. And is that the best way for people to get a hold of you there as well, or?
Absolutely. Yep. Hit the website and you can contact me there, and happy to talk to you.
Awesome. Are you on any of the socials, Insta or Facebook or?
Yes.
Any of those places?
Facebook is, I think, quite simply facebook.com/TomZeeb. Instagram is TomZeeb Traction, which is the name of my business, and all the other socials as well, which I think we have those all linked to from TomZeeb.com as well.
Awesome. Well, appreciate you being here. There was a ton of information, ton to, you know, unpack. If people want to know more about all of the fun things with real estate investing, go check out Tom's free stuff. And if you want to know more about what he's coaching and training on, you know, check out some of his programs there on his website. All right, guys, thanks for watching and listening, and we'll catch you guys on the next episode.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Success Agent Podcast, hosted by JP Fluellen. To find more content, go to WyomingRealEstateCareers.com. Please also go to Success Agent on Apple Podcasts, hit subscribe, and if you find the content valuable, please share this podcast and give it a 5-star review. It helps us with our rankings. This has been another episode of the Success Agent Podcast.